All right, everybody. Here we are, Living in Letterbox, episode 28. Thank you for joining us. I'm Andrew LaPointe.
And I'm Stephen Keyswetter.
And we have a bit of an exciting development that Stephen had just told me, which is you're all high tech now.
I am. I'm going up in the world. We are experimentally. This podcast is recorded via Skype, as per usual, except I'm using the Skype interface on my fancy brand new Xbox One. So I'm sitting on my couch, very comfortable, as opposed to my usual desk setting.
Where I'm sitting.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I'm a little more comfortable than you are right now, Andrew. But that being said, we know what sort of relationship this our recording has had with technology. So I can't say I'm for certain that this will go 100%, but I'm hoping. I've got a good feeling.
Well, I mean, this is the Xbox One, right? So
yeah, it's the future, so it must work, right?
Yeah, like things shouldn't fail anymore with, you know, with all the advancements made every Christmas.
Yeah. Those are famous last words. Things shouldn't fail.
Things shouldn't fail. It's the internet.
Exactly. The internet's always working. Mm-hmm. Everything the internet does is perfect. But yeah, so we'll see how that goes. We'll let our listeners give us feedback if it sounds better, the same, worse, that sort of thing. But I think it has some potential because I'm comfortable. I've got a pillow and a couch. It's pretty awesome.
Wow. I need to get one of those.
Yeah, get on that.
So I think we should just get right into it because there's a
sure.
We have a big news item that we have to discuss. Mm-hmm. Because I know that you're a big Fast and Furious fan.
I am.
So we have to discuss the tragic death of Paul Walker, who we all know passed away in a car accident, I guess, just a few days ago.
Mm-hmm. Yep, just a couple days ago.
And I'm on firstshowing.net to mm-hmm. get some news because one of the big questions I had was, what does this mean for Fast and Furious 7?
Yeah.
Which they had just begun shooting, as far as I know.
Yeah, I'm pretty certain that they were almost halfway through production, so they've got a significant amount of footage in the can, as they say, and I'm not sure what the news article that you're reading has said, but I have read news to the effect that Universal is making decisions about possibly scrapping all existing footage and rewriting and starting again. So I don't know.
Yeah,
what
I mean,
have you read?
I think that's basically what it says here. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, what else could they do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a major character and like it wouldn't be as simple as just recasting the role, you know, like yeah. Seven movies in. So I guess.
And the thing with it too is, I mean, we obviously don't know the extent of how much of his scenes were shot, what role his character plays, because it's a big cast, right? It's like,
yeah.
I mean, he's a key member, and I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see how they, you know, take this on. But I mean, the reality is this has happened before in other movies. Mm-hmm. The one that came to mind was Gladiator. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, right,
but,
Oliver Reed.
Oliver Reed, yeah, passed away having only shot about 50%, from what I remember. Again, I could have my facts not quite accurate, but about 50% of his footage had been shot, and Ridley Scott then went to the computer graphics technology team and said, what can we do about this? And they were able to utilize existing footage and some digital trickery in order to complete the rest of his scenes. It slightly different, you know, adapted versions of his other footage. Mm-hmm. But that is something that, I mean, it's technology is moving at a fast pace. And I'd be curious to see if that isn't a possible option that was discussed. Who knows, right? But I mean, I think first to say though too is, I mean, we went straight into the discussion about what it means to the franchise, and I mean, I think that's an apt direction due to the fact that I think that it'd be safe to say that Paul Walker is an essential part of that whole Fast and Furious franchise. He's the biggest constant throughout the whole series.
Yeah.
He's been in more of the films than Vin Diesel, even. Like, he's been all the way through. And
is he even in Tokyo Drift?
He's not in Tokyo Drift, but in all fairness, none of the core characters are in Tokyo Drift.
Right.
So that's sort of the black sheep of the series, which, though, Seven, the one that's being shot right now, brings sort of Tokyo Drift back into the fray and collects it into the mythology of the series. But I mean, Paul Walker's done some amazing work. I've never been a huge champion of his per se.
No,
but
me
I've
neither.
I've liked a lot of the movies he's been in.
Mm-hmm.
So it was weird reading the news because I don't know why. I mean, it hit me, I don't want to say hard per se, but I was surprised. I guess it was so out of nowhere that it definitely took me aback and I went, wow.
Because he's a young guy and the death of someone young is always shocking.
Exactly.
You know, young and healthy. And
I think that always makes it that much more reflective in the sense that you really don't know, right? Like our clock is ticking and it's scary really when you think about it.
Yeah.
But he'll be missed by a lot of people and I think that his presence, like you said, in the series, which I am a huge fan of, it makes you wonder because Universal's got a lot of investment. Fast and Furious is a series that has a lot of legs and just keeps getting bigger.
Yeah.
And so they will have to address this from a business standpoint, but as well from a, you know, they'll have to be tactful and make sure
they gotta maintain sensitivity.
Honor. Yeah, exactly. Sensitivity is definitely the right word for that. But we shall see how it goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's too early to tell. Other than they've shut down production and retooling the script, and yeah, I guess we'll see. That'll be a definitely on your radar. But I was never a fan of these movies. I mean, I've only seen the first one and the second one.
Right.
And then I kind of just, I mean, with sequel after sequel and the titling got confusing to me, like Fast and Furious.
It does. Yeah.
And The Fast and Furious. So it's like, you know, isn't that a bit of a marketing nightmare? You know, like for someone like me who isn't as invested in the series as you are.
Yeah, no, it is. I can speak firsthand. I mean, I work, I sell movies for a living, and people often come up with all of the films and with a look of confusion on their face. The titles are confusing. It definitely kind of gets a little wacky after the third one. But Universal knows what they're doing, I think, with this series. So it'll be around for a while.
Yeah, the proof is in the pudding for sure.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I've said it before. I would plop down my money and pre-order my ticket for, you know, film 7 through 10 if I could. Like
even though they got to rewrite the script.
Ready for more. Yeah, I mean, this is I'm still looking forward to the film, but now with a certain level of hesitancy and sadness. But
yeah.
Who knows?
Mm. Yeah, that's a shame for sure. But let's move on. And I want to know, since we don't really talk outside of the show that much, like you're a busy guy and I got my stuff and like, you know, we watch a lot of movies, but we never really know what we're seeing until, you know, we hit the microphones. So
this is so true.
I've seen some really interesting stuff even just over the last few days. But I'll just start with you and ask what have you seen that you want to talk about?
There's a couple of things that I've seen that I think are really interesting, but one that I do want to talk about, I didn't enjoy, but I really feel that you're going to like it.
Oh, okay. So, I'm all ears.
Because I was watching it and as I was watching this film, it was puzzling me and challenging me and making me scratch my head and go, I'm not sure what this movie's going for, but I really feel that Andrew would appreciate this. I think he'd think it's a bit of a gem. And that is a film which maybe you've seen. I don't know. It's a 1983 comedy called Deal of the Century, directed by William Friedkin.
I've heard of this movie. This is Chevy Chase and Sigourney Weaver.
Absolutely, okay. Yeah, and Gregory Hines.
Okay.
And I don't know. I picked it up. It's I don't buy many movies anymore because, as we've discussed before, I've got this giant, as you do, this backlog. My pile of shame is huge. Mm-hmm. But I was at a used CD shop here, or, you know, CD DVD shop here in town, and it's rare that I come across something on the shelf that just intrigues me instantly, and I hadn't heard of it. And the cast, the director, just the write up on the DVD case made me instantly snatch it up, and it was for like $4. Like, it wasn't a huge investment on my behalf, but I felt, hey, this might be interesting. It's I mean, Chevy Chase, you know, early 80s, is going to be at the prime of his career. William Friedkin, a director who I really respect and I think does interesting work, whom off the top of my head, I can't think of any other comedies. I mean, I don't feel like comedies are his strength necessarily.
Not really, no.
And then, yeah, like Sigourney Weaver, I just thought, well, this has got a lot going for it. I have to get this. I have to watch this, and really made a point of not only picking it up, but shooting it to the top of my pile of shame so that I would get to it, because I thought this might be really interesting fodder for the podcast. I even thought instantly when I bought it. Regrettably, it didn't live up to my expectations. I suppose having expectations of this film, having not heard of it, was probably the first indicator that maybe it's not a good movie. Uh-huh. Because with that sort of pedigree, you'd think that if it was a comic gem, I might have come across it at some point. But I'll tell you just a little bit about it. And so you haven't seen this movie?
No.
I'm just excited that you've even heard of it, because I hadn't. It was not on my radar at all. But and I'm gonna quickly tell you a little bit about the film and what I thought about it and why I think you might like it. But Chevy Chase plays sort of an arms dealer, a legitimate arms dealer, sort of a used car salesman for American military weaponry. He's sort of like Tony Stark, but a very kind of sleazy, mind you, then Tony Stark is kind of sleazy as well, yeah. I suppose, in a way, but a much more sort of back alley used car salesman kind of version of Tony Stark. And he specifically deals in selling American-made weaponry and military technology, but to third world countries.
Mm-hmm.
So he tends to – he does a lot of flipping, actually. It seems in the film it's suggested that he'll buy used weaponry from either aborted – you know, modern day civil wars that are just back on the market that he'll buy, clean up. He actually has a whole part where he buys used flamethrowers that are all rusty, but then has Gregory Hines' character clean them with, like, you know, WD-40 and sandpaper, just to flip them to another country that's going into a war. Like, it's got this sort of weird black comedy sensibility, which on paper sounds awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you kind of think of films like Thank You for Smoking, which is, you know, a film that talks a lot about the tobacco industry.
Yeah, like cynical like political comedies.
Yeah, exactly. No, for sure. And that's what I was expecting going into this film, except it's not at all funny. And it seems really confused about its tone. It starts off in a little bit of a sort of a serious, dark vibe, but it's more a sketch comedy than anything. It's very disjointed. I watched it with my wife, and even my wife looked at me and she goes, I don't understand what's going on in this movie. Like, it starts, and it's more like a montage of scenes that are loosely tied together. And it's kind of like they had this gem of a premise, and then they did a bunch of improvising and shot all these random sequences and then kind of cut them together. It seems very unprofessional.
Really?
It's just, yeah, it's really weird. Like, it's absolutely everything about it is the opposite of what I expected. I expected a fairly polished, dark, biting political satire. Instead, I got a really goofy, silly, disjointed fluff fest. However, I feel that your penchant for the sort of Kentucky Fried Movie type of humor might actually work in this case. I think you might really look at it as a bunch of, you know, vignettes that I think might hit a really golden note with you. I feel like this might be a gem for Andrew. I don't know. I mean, it's. I hesitate to recommend it because I didn't like it. However, I feel it might fit your comic sensibilities. So take that as you will.
So you're saying maybe it's just misunderstood.
It could, yeah, maybe it could be your Hudson Hawk, which is, you know, I'm a huge champion of Hudson Hawk.
I like that movie a lot when I was a kid. Film. I remember seeing Hudson Hawk on like pay-per-view or something when I was a kid, and I just loved it. But it's like this one of these notorious flops, right?
Yeah, and if this film kind of has that vibe in the sense that it feels almost unfinished in ways, but I think that if it hits your funny bone, it'll resonate really well. One of the interesting things is Gregory Hines plays his character goes through an arc through the film where he becomes a born again Christian, and comes to really be concerned about what he's doing, about the fact that he is, you know, selling arms and planes and all this weaponry to countries that are you know, either, you know, genocidal or just, you know, dictatorships. And he really comes to have some sort of ethical debate about this and literally turns into a born again Christian, including a really unusual and random baptism sequence that just kind of comes out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. But near the end, the sort of the third act of the film takes place at a weaponry expo, for lack of a better word. I'm gonna get a few spoilers because I don't think anyone's gonna really watch it, but I do want. I think you're gonna.
But I'll
watch
it.
But he ends up hijacking sort of like an F-14 military plane, and threatens to blow up the entire expo if everyone doesn't get down and start praying. Like, it just has this ridiculous premise that he ends up becoming this like crazed religious martyr that it made me, I suppose, I'm chuckling. Like, it did make me smile. The movie never made me laugh, but his character's development and his character's story arc in particular was the highlight, if there was.
So, I mean, it sounds to
me in the film,
it sounds to me like it's really broad.
Oh yeah,
like, and maybe that's why you didn't like it.
I think that's probably a really good reason or good explanation for why I didn't like it.
Yeah.
It's not very focused at all. I feel like it really could have nailed some of its darker notes with a much better, tighter script. But it's just weird. And I went out of the way. I haven't actually read much about it since I watched it. I kind of wanted to watch it fresh, not know anything about it, especially since, like I said, I pulled it off a shelf for like $4 at a used shop, having never heard about it. But I have a sneaky suspicion that I'm going to go online and read a little bit about this. Mm-hmm. And it's going to have been a flop. I mean, I did
probably
notice the IMDb rating is like 4, which never... Well, it can bode well sometimes if you're in the mood for a movie that's a 4, but I really thought this was going to be – I was looking for a gem. I really wanted to come out and say, hey, check out this movie that I've quote-unquote discovered, and I can't believe I've never heard of it before, except I guess the lesson learned is sometimes you haven't heard of a movie for good reason.
Well, I can't blame you because the movie has the star power, and it's got the director,
yeah.
So – you know, it's just one of those, the opposite of a hidden gem, maybe kind of a hidden turkey or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I never thought of that. Perhaps there is a hidden turkey. I like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that is one of the films that I checked out that I am recommending to you, my fellow
co-host,
but
me.
Not necessarily recommending to any of our listeners.
See, I got to find a movie like that for you. But I mean, it's usually pretty accidental, so...
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, I could not have gone out of my way to find this film. It's just it the universe told me to watch it, I feel, in many ways. And perhaps the reason I was watching it was not because I was going to get enjoyment out of it, but because the universe knew that I would pass the word to you, who would in turn get enjoyment out of it.
Okay.
And that is Deal of the Century.
Okay, so now, so I am obligated to watch this now.
I feel like you are.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to it. Whether, you know, it good. Sucks or I find it good. Yeah. I mean, who knows?
On the plus side, the movie clocks in at a sharp 90 minutes. Like, okay. It doesn't overstay its welcome. Even though it does feel a bit long, it is 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. So there you go. You won't have to invest a huge amount of your movie watching time. So that's good. Okay. But yeah, what have you seen? I mean, it sounds like you I know you've probably seen some very interesting and new things that I'm interested that I want to hear about. So bring it.
Well, I've seen four new movies. I guess they count as theatrical. I mean, one I saw on demand, but it is playing in theaters as well. But mm-hmm. I just want to start with 12 Years a Slave, which I saw a few weeks ago.
Right, I think it's the Steve McQueen.
Yeah, it is. Steve McQueen, I'm a huge fan of now. I mean, like, he's done two other movies, Hunger and Shame, both with Michael mm-hmm. Fassbender, which are, like, amazing films. And, you know, he's scored a hat trick here with 12 Years a Slave, which is probably the best movie I've seen all year, next to The World's End, which I just watched again recently, and it's that movie is, I just love that movie. So that movie and 12 Years a Slave are like my top two for the year. And this is just, I mean, a really devastating and, you know, compelling tale of this man who was a free man. He was a black man in, you know, slave times, but he was living in like upstate New York. True story of, this man named Solomon Northup. He mm-hmm. was living in upstate New York. He had a wife and a couple kids. He was a violinist, very intellectual man, you know, respected. And then one night he has the misfortune of meeting these two men who are very, you know, charismatic and charming to him. And they say, well, you know, we want to give you some work. We want to put you in this traveling circus or something. And they take him to dinner and they get him drunk. And I guess they end up drugging him. And next thing he knows, he's on a slave ship. He's been stolen and sold into slavery. And this is his long journey of just enduring the worst possible treatment, you know, a human being can endure. And it's, like I said, it's very devastating, but just like a really, just an excellent movie on all fronts. I mean, like just direction and cinematography, editing especially. Like I love the way this movie was cut, because it's not very linear. It kind of cuts back and forth, at least in the beginning, between when he was free and when he was captured. And the lead actor, Chiwetel Ejiofor, I believe.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I believe that's
how you pronounce it. He is he's amazing in this movie. It's just an incredible performance. And you also have, and the cast in general, like you have Michael Fassbender, who's this like really evil drunken slave master, plantation owner, and Benedict Cumberbatch from Star Trek Into Darkness. Mm-hmm. And Sherlock, he plays another slave master, but he's a kind of a benevolent slave master, and that he likes Solomon a lot, and because what's interesting about this film is that here's this guy, and he's very intellectual and very smart, but in order for him to survive, he really has to play dumb, because you know. These slave owners, these racists, you know, are convinced that these people are like subhuman and can't read or write. And these fellow slaves are telling him, like, don't tell people you can read or write, you know, don't say anything, you know, like basically he has to play dumb. And he has a lot of pride, and, you know, because of what he goes through, like he can't do it. So that's just part of his endurance, really, is like, you know, I don't know. It's just very, it's very interesting. The idea that he has to not only endure all this like horrible, physical and mental torture, but he also has to, you know, dumb himself down in order to survive is like a really interesting element to it.
Like the idea of having to suppress your own intelligence to avoid discrimination is pretty compelling.
Which, like I said, he has a hard time doing because the people who you know, ostensibly own him, quote unquote, aren't really that bright, you know, and he has to take orders from them. And he's like the smartest person in the room always. So it's, you know, that just adds another level of you know, sadness to it. And I hope I'm not making this sound like oh, this is just such a depressing, soul-crushing movie. Some people may see it like that, but it's really wonderful. Like it's just it's a rewarding experience. I mean, if I think one person walked out like maybe halfway through because it is quite violent. I mean, you know, it gets very visceral with the whippings. Like you see what happens to like their flesh and everything. It could be very hard to take. And I guess because, you know, Django was last year and that was my favorite movie of last year, you know, you want to kind of compare the two. But, you know, two very different movies. I mean, Django is like, you know, the pulpy kind of spaghetti Western treatment of like a real shameful part of American history. And it's great on that front. And then, you know, this film probably might be a little bit more realistic.
But
I wouldn't say which one is better or anything like that. I just think they're totally, totally different on a lot of levels. But this movie is, I can't recommend it enough.
I'd like to check it out ever since I, had first read some of the coverage, which admittedly was mostly about director Steve McQueen, not about the film, at the Toronto Film Festival, because he himself is a rather eccentric filmmaker in the way he engages with the media.
I didn't know that. I mean, to be honest, I don't think I've seen an interview with him. I've seen photos of him, but I haven't really seen any like interviews with him. So.
And I think there's good reason is he's a very combative interview subject.
Oh, really?
And he does tend to, if he differs with the interviewer's opinion, he's likely to just yell and scream and tantrum a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, which is his right, because he defends his art very, very explicitly. And he sees his films as being sort of his single vision, and that it's very much precise and correct in its existence. But I think that people who challenge him are in for an interesting surprise. And so I know for a fact that his ability to do PR, particularly for this film, was dialed back a little bit by the distributor for that exact reason. And I find that interesting because I think it's like, I mean, it's challenging subject matter, so why not have a challenging director, a director who really challenges what people think and say about him and his films? So I applaud him on that, but I think he's definitely burned some media bridges.
Because you got to talk to every movie, you're talking to the same people a lot. So
well, exactly, it's such a grind, right? Like I can't imagine what it's like to be an actor or a director or a producer who has to do PR all around the world and answer the same, like most of them are inane and idiotic questions that you get over and over again. And I think he's just a filmmaker who has decided to say, look, I'm not going to answer these bullshit questions over and over again. And instead I'm going to tell you what I think and talk about subjects I'm interested in. And the way mainstream media is right now, it's not prepared to digest that correctly.
Well, yeah, because
these
interviews are like the 5-minute, you know, little junket interviews. So there's not room for a lot of substance.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a shame because I think he's a director who would bring lots of substance to the right questions. So it's sort of a roundabout way to kind of learn a lot about the film, but it did definitely put it on my radar. And you're not the first person to have I've talked to have quite a glowing review of the film. So I do want to check it out. It is most definitely something of interest to me.
Yeah, he's definitely a guy who's like on my radar now. If he has a new film coming out, mm-hmm. no matter what the subject matter is, I'm definitely there.
You're on board.
Yeah, and he's made three films now that are all, if one thing, I mean, two things in common. Michael Fassbender's in all of them, and mm-hmm. and he's terrific. He's a great actor, and also, you know, very touchy, difficult subject matter. You know, Hunger was about, you know, starvation and you know,
and imprisonment,
and you know, the IRA politics and all that. Yeah. And Shame is about sexual addiction, which, you know, if there are other movies about sexual addiction, they may. There's one out now called Thanks for Sharing with Gwyneth Paltrow, which seems to be more of a sitcom-y kind of treatment of that. I mean, I haven't seen the film, but it's definitely a more lighthearted take on that. Whereas Shame is, you know, a little difficult to swallow, probably for a lot of people, and it's very frank and direct. And then you have 12 Years a Slave, which is just about, you know, human beings, you know, just being abused by another race. And it's, you know, you're looking at this and you have to digest it as, you know, this really happened, because it's not really, this isn't a subject matter that cinema has really explored that deeply. I mean, what else has there been? There's been Django, and there's been like Roots on television. You know, so he's definitely a brave filmmaker, you know, so I it doesn't surprise me that he seems like a difficult guy.
Yeah. But yeah, so you're doing good duty in on behalf of this podcast for watching actual relevant new films, because to be quite honest, oftentimes I feel as though I'm still living in the mid 80s for the amount of films I watched from that period. But what else have you engaged with?
Oh, man, recently? I don't want to seem like I'm bragging with here's what else I watched. I saw.
No, it's good. No, it's good. I love it.
Well, I mean, there's still like even then it's like there's still all these other movies that like I just have not gotten around to seeing. So it's like even when I'm seeing all, you know, these movies that I should be seeing, I feel like it's not enough, you know.
Right.
I did see Blue is the Warmest Color, which is, you know, another really difficult. You know, another difficult film from a difficult director, reportedly. You know, this is a story of these two young women who fall in love, and it's their 10-year journey through their relationship. You know, this young high school girl who, you know, doesn't realize she has these feelings for the same sex. And she falls in love with this girl who's like maybe a year or two older in art college. And it's just this, it's really about her, this girl, Adele, meeting this blue haired girl. And it's just this obsession and this need. And, you know, their relationship through like a 10-year period. It's a 3-hour film.
Wow, I didn't realize it was actually that long.
Yeah, technically it's two films, a part one and a part two. Combined into one for, I guess, North American release. And it's based on a graphic novel, too. And I admired this film a lot. I don't think it grabbed me the way, I don't think it really had an effect on me the same way that, like, 12 Years a Slave did. I think because, first of all, I'll say that the two actresses in this film are fantastic. These are, like, you know, these are really committed performances, you know, especially since there's a lot, it's very physical. They're, you know, the sex scenes are, you know, more than convincing, and, you know, very graphic and all that. You know, beautifully shot and everything. And despite the running time, you know, it, I don't know if it needed to be that long per se, but it never felt draggy or anything. I think if I have a criticism of it is that it maybe it was a little too straightforward in a way for me, and that it's essentially like they fall in love and then something happens where, you know, their relationship is kind of dissipates. And I kind of expected a lot of that. So I think the movie just didn't have a lot of there weren't as many layers to the story that I would have liked to have seen. You know what I mean?
Right.
But other than that, it's definitely a worthy movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's another one that, you know, I've read and heard a little bit about, but I didn't even realize that it had played locally, to be quite honest. That's how out of the loop I am sometimes. Or did you see that? Was that, that wasn't on demand? You saw that in the theater?
Yeah, I saw that in theaters. And but Criterion is doing the DVD in February, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'll probably get that and watch it again. You know.
So it's good. It's good enough for a rewatch and a purchase, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But I would say I really like the film, and I don't know if I loved it. You know, I think I need to kind of reevaluate it for sure.
Right.
What else? Oh, there's one movie here.
You should read the source material. I'd be curious.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Are
yeah.
you much of a, like a, read it before I see the movie kind of person? You know how there
Not
are
really.
Two philosophies. There are those who like to read and then those who are like to see the movie first and then maybe visit the source material.
Well, here's what I've learned about that. People will complain if it's like definitely if it's something like Harry Potter where the book is really important to people and it's really popular and then they see the movie, their complaint, their criticism will be, well, it's not faithful to the novel.
Right.
And the problem with that is that, well, it doesn't really have to, it, being faithful to the novel is totally not the point.
Agreed.
The only thing you really have to be faithful to if you're adapting someone's book is like the essence of the story. Not, you know, scene by scene, you know, line by line, you know what I mean? Cause that's just pretty boring.
Yep.
And I think people complain about that when they don't get that. You know, because these two mediums are like so different that, you know, I don't understand why people think that they have to be synchronized like that.
And however, you said it's based on a graphic novel. There is versus reading a novel where your imagination is your primary power for building the characters and the story. With a graphic novel, it does slightly close the gap in the sense that a comic can be very cinematic.
Yeah, because it almost like storyboards.
Yep, exactly. And so that's why I think sometimes the adaptation of comics like that are that much more intriguing to look as a side-by-side comparison because they are already, and like you said, they're basically laid out. You kind of want to look at the filmmaking team and go, hey, did they use the graphic as a storyboard layout or did they, you know, use it as a jumping point to keep, you know, to your point, the spirit and the tone of the original source material? So that's always intriguing.
I just got the Django Unchained graphic novel hardcover.
Okay, it comes out, it's an adaptation though, right?
Yeah.
It's not a new story.
It's the adaptation of the entire script. Because Tarantino writes these big scripts and he's got to eliminate a lot of stuff in terms of the shooting. I mean, he probably shoots it, but it ends up on the cutting room floor. But even looking at the illustrations, I mean, you know, this was done after the movie was made, I believe, or maybe before it came out. But, you know, illustration wise, I mean, Christoph Waltz's character isn't really drawn like Christoph Waltz in a lot of ways.
Okay.
So, cool. You know, there's definitely a different interpretation there. You know, you're looking at that character, but it's not like, you know, a caricature of the actors. You know what I mean?
Right,
so definitely different interpretation there, even though it's a more visual medium that kind of, you know, is a little bit more of an easier, you know, an easier transfer over to, you know. You're not, my point is that you're not just drawing the movie, you know, it's the artist kind of do his or her own take on
has its own life.
Yeah, the look of the characters and the sets and everything.
Mm-hmm. Cool. No, you have to let me know how that is because that that definitely sounds like an interesting experiment. It's the reverse. It's kind of like the, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I don't know if you were like this, but I really loved novelizations.
Yeah.
I think it's before
them,
I really
they?
Appreciate they do, yeah, but I don't think they're nearly as prevalent as they used to be.
They used to be huge.
Exactly. Huge.
And
like, I mean, you go to
for
any...
like for movies that are like, why is there a novel of, you know?
Yeah, seriously.
Predator 2.
And it would be like a bestseller. And I don't know why. Maybe it was just when I was a kid, because I could read the novelizations, to be quite honest, of movies I wasn't allowed to watch. So that was always a little bit of a factor, I think. Yeah. But everything had a novelization based on a screenplay by, and there were certain
just a way to sell the movie.
Certain authors' names.
These aren't literary works. It's like it's just like a poster or a soundtrack. It's just another marketing
tool. It's another marketing tool. But I can't recall the last time I really went. Not that I ever look for them, but the last time I went into a bookshop and saw, a movie tie-in section where it was all novelizations. But I think in this case, this is something really interesting. Mm-hmm. Sort of experimenting with that idea, but
in
graphic form.
These have obviously more artistic aspirations to them, whereas the novelizations were just hack work, really. Mm. I remember going to the dollar store and finding a novelization of Another 48 Hours. And I never read
See, like that, why?
I never read it, but I just thought it was so cool. It's like, wow, a book version of this movie. just like movies that, would not lend themselves to books, but they do a book anyway, just because it sells the movie.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I always feel like when novelizations were really popular at like the drugstore on those like those turning book, racks. So it would be that kind of thing. Like it was definitely marketed not to be, quote unquote high end, but just something that was very much everyday person available out there right beside the magazine rack. There was a stack of here are all the blockbusters in theaters right now and you can read them.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I just had the point. I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Yeah, definitely worth mentioning because that's sort of a forgotten thing. Though I'm sure there's lots of...
I guarantee there's a website out there that specializes specifically in the celebration of the novelization. I'm going to look into that because I think that would be an interesting subject matter.
Yeah, I think I've seen one once or twice, but yeah, definitely. Like just looking at the covers, like, oh, they made a novelization of that movie?
Yeah. Well, because and I think novelizations in many ways, I think were what DVDs and Blu-rays are to our generation in the sense that we get all like the stuff that hits the cutting room floor, like the unfinished sequences, and a novelization in many ways was as Django is, it was based on the screenplay and often written in conjunction or side by side during the film production. Mm-hmm. So it would be kind of like the director's cut in many ways. There'd be entire sequences or characters that were included in the novelization that were never in the finished film product. Mm-hmm. And I think that was an allure as well. It was kind of a way to see if you liked a movie enough, you could get a little deeper, into the characters and the film by experiencing it in novel form. So that's
especially cool. I mean, I think there were rare cases where the screenwriter did the novelization.
Mm-hmm.
So then it would be probably closer to the film or to the script rather than just some other writer,
Yeah. Well, I think probably the biggest example of that ever and just occurred to me would be I know that Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey is sort of based on Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 Space Odyssey, except Arthur C. Clarke was writing it at the same time that the movie was being made. So it was sort of this collaborative back and forth. So when it came out, it was the movie, but it was also, it's distinctly different in its own way
I think they did that with The Godfather as well. I think when Mario Puzo was writing the
Puzo was reading?
Yeah, when Mario Puzo was writing The Godfather, I think Paramount was developing it into a film.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because when people talk
the things you learn.
Yeah, when people talk about The Godfather, they don't really talk about the book. I mean, I haven't read the book, but apparently it's a little bit more straightforward and less operatic than, the movie.
Yeah. I've always kind of thought I've always meant to read the book. I think it would be interesting to check it out. Because it is one of those cases where you're right, the movie far overshadows the book, and I am certain that many, many people who are Godfather fans don't necessarily even realize that it's based on a book.
But there are also sequels and like spin-offs, because Mario Puzo's dead, but like there are like up like a few years ago, there was like a Godfather 4 kind of. You know how they do that with the Bourne series, like Robert Ludlum's dead, but someone is still writing kind of spin-offs to them.
And they, it's called, now it's under sort of like the Bourne
Retribution or something.
Yeah, it has a subtitle and it's sort of Robert Ludlum Presents.
Yeah.
But they do the same thing now. I mean, with even and they'll continue with Tom Clancy.
Yeah.
A lot of his characters will just continue, but yeah, this is quite the tangent. Now we're talking about, you know, Robert Ludlum books. As a total aside, and some of the people listening will be nodding their head knowing what I'm going to say. I read so much Robert Ludlum when I was in high school. I pretty much, like, I worshipped at the altar of Robert Ludlum. Everything. I remember reading the Bourne trilogy when I was, I don't know, it must have been in like, I would have been about grade 7, I suppose, reading the original Bourne trilogy. And I just love them. I could not get enough of those very sort of convoluted, globe-trotting, spy, action-adventure novels. And I just love that stuff. And I don't know. I think it was kind of cool that they eventually, you know, because there was an adaptation of The Bourne Identity many, many, many years ago.
Yep.
That's not very good. But the Matt Damon films were half decent. But
did you read The Osterman Weekend?
I did. I literally read everything. Osterman Weekend, Holcroft Covenant, Icarus Agenda, all that stuff. They always had these great titles, and the paperbacks were also pulpy, and they had this really interesting design where there'd be this. I think it must have been inspired somewhat by the Ian Fleming 007 dust jackets, because I in the years since, I've seen what were considered sort of authentic republished editions of the Bond films, and they had sort of this circular medallion-sized artwork that then had this sort of 70s-style circular pattern that built out of it. But when you opened the cover, then it showed the full splash page of that artwork.
Right.
Like, I don't know. It's hard to describe, but it sort of had
children's
that books, feel.
Aren't there, that's kind of a children's book thing.
yeah, it is, where it's sort of, the full piece of art is hidden under the cover. But, yeah, I would pick up the Robert Ludlum stuff like nobody's business. Just loved it. I mean, the titles and the adventures and something.
This may be
it.
A stupid question. Do you like, have you seen and do you like the Osterman Weekend movie?
I have seen it. I remember not really liking it. But
it's a hard movie to like because it's so problematic.
I saw it again when I was big into these novels. Like me and a buddy of mine, Justin, I remember we rented it specifically because we had read the book, and I remember not because it's who the heck directed
Sam
it?
Sam Peckinpah. It was Sam Peckinpah.
Sam Peckinpah. That's it.
Sam Peckinpah's last movie.
I feel like I might like it now more than I did then because I was probably in like grade 7 or 8 when I rented it, and I remember finding it kind of dull compared to the novel.
I think it's pretty well. It's got some kind of flair visually. I mean, Sam Peckinpah, he was pretty much at the end of his rope at that point. He died like a year after the movie came out. But, you know, you can tell that he directed it by watching it. There's some cool moments in it, even though, you can tell the screenplay is a total mess. And, like, there's the DVD, the Anchor Bay put out a really terrific DVD of it. That has like this really.
Yeah, they did when it was like the Divi Max 2-disc version or something.
There's a really great making of where they talk about Sam Peckinpah actually said, like, he met a buddy of his and hey, Sam, what are you working on right now? And he said something like, I'm trying really hard to adapt this Robert Ludlum piece of shit into a movie.
as he was drinking.
It's
right on. Now I should revisit that. That would be interesting.
Yeah, it's a fun but terribly flawed movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't remember it very well, but yeah, that's an excellent aside.
Yeah. That kind of brings it all together.
Oh, for sure. I don't know. Where do you want to go from
Have you seen anything else that you want to mention?
Oh gosh, I've seen lots of stuff. I think that not lots of stuff. That would be a lie. I've seen films. One thing that it seems like every month I always have at least one sort of documentary recommendation. And I saw it. I think it's it was apropos if I mention it, due to the fact that I'm even recording on a video game console
Okay.
right now, is I saw the documentary called Indie Game, the movie. And I don't know if you've seen this. I know that
I've heard of
it made the rounds, played theatrically, is really popular on demand. And it's basically a look at what it is like in today's gaming industry to be an independent developer, making a game and looking for publication and trying to balance PR in your life. But it's really a harsh, harsh look at the fact that it's an unforgiving, like slave-driven industry that doesn't really allow you to have much of a life if you want to work as a game developer.
Yeah.
And it follows the development of three separate games that are all out now, and I've actually played two of them, so I felt involved in this in a way that I kind of knew what the end product was going to be like, and I was kind of invested in it because I'm not what one would consider a hardcore gamer, but I am a gamer to the extent that I do game. And but one of the particular game developers spent 5 years of his life and destroyed relationship, legal issues,
wow.
health issues. I mean, all three of the games that go in development, all of the developers have extreme bouts of depression, and it's because it's unrelentingly, I guess, a solo experience in a way. I mean, one of the moments in this documentary that really sort of resonated with me is one of the makers of a game called Super Meat Boy talks about his wife's experience of him making a game, and that she comments that the part of him that she's most familiar with is the back of his head.
Oh my God.
Because he's always sitting sort of just face into a computer working, 20 hours a day coding, making this game that their relationship is really strained. And I think it's a testament to his wife, to be quite honest, that she sticks around. He's one of the ones whose relationship does survive the making of a game. And I mean, it takes a special person to be patient with that type of commitment to your work. But I think it's just, even if you're not a gamer at all, if you're a gamer, you're going to go, oh, wow, I really appreciate the amount of effort and work that's going into these games. However, I see that this is clearly an unhealthy industry.
Mm-hmm.
But as a non-gamer, this will give you all the more reason to be a non-gamer. Like, it'll really turn you off. Because it does. It sort of paints a somewhat perverse and one-sided image or idea that all gamers are reclusive nerds who have no lives, and which I fight against regularly because I don't think that's the case.
Yeah.
I think gaming is a very vibrant and social and interesting experience. But I think that this documentary, from at least from an industry side, really makes it look so not at all fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people who work in the industry, and I've kind of gotten firsthand stories about the craziness that is required in regards to work expectation, and it's just ridiculous.
You would think, before you watch this, that this would be about the joy of creating something.
Yeah,
it doesn't sound like that at all.
No, it's not. I mean, even in so okay, one of the extreme examples of that is one of the games gets a publisher, is going to be premiered on the Xbox Microsoft system, and the sort of talking head moment, the interview, the day that it comes out, because the filmmakers are with one of the game developers, is that the reception to his game is all positive. It's selling, it's breaking records. It's just pushing him deeper and deeper into a sense of disillusionment and anger and sadness. That it's inverse. You would think that the more popular his game was, the more fulfilled he would be about the experience of putting it out there. But it works in the opposite. He's just totally angry in a way that people are enjoying his game, and he's not at all relieved that it's out there in the world and can only see its flaws. And it's Yeah, like, it definitely it's not a feel-good documentary by any stretch of the imagination, and it challenges the way you think about gaming as an entertainment format. But it does, take its time a little bit to discuss the artistry of gaming versus the entertainment value of gaming. But I personally can't imagine. I enjoy a lot of things in life, and I imagine in many ways the stories of Indie Game, the movie, would apply to the way people make movies. People do sacrifice a lot of their personal lives to get films made, particularly if you're making an independent film. But at least in a film, you're still working with a fairly large team. There is a certain social element, whereas in game coding, it literally is like people, like one individual, one sole person doing the entire production, spending 5 years of their life not knowing whether it'll be successful or not. That's a commitment that I honestly, I don't know about you, but there is nothing in the world that I am so confident or interested in that I could devote 5 years of my life to do solo work on. Like, I don't have, it takes a special kind of person
Yeah,
to have
you
that
gotta,
type of
it's
drive.
gotta be an
I don't
obsession.
have it. You know, actually, yeah, it is. It's very much an obsession. And when
It's
your
like
obsession comes to
joy has nothing to do
fruition,
with it. I mean, maybe a little bit in the beginning, but
no, it seems like, I don't know, like, I can't even imagine wanting to play a game after having spent all that time doing games. Like, I wouldn't feel inspired to be a gamer if all I did was sit in front of a computer and make a game. I feel like I'd want to do the opposite. I'd become like the best person at like going for walks. Like, nature walks would become my like favorite thing in the world if that was my job. You know what I mean? So, but yeah, so that's Indie Game the movie, just a really fascinating documentary that I think is well worth seeing and is easily accessible. It's out there everywhere. I mean, I watched it on Netflix. Yeah, definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, awesome. There is one documentary that I actually want to, now that we're on documentaries, I do want to recommend. It's called Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. It's a musical documentary about this rock band,
Big
Big
Star?
Star from
Wicked.
early 70s, and it's all about, like, they're basically a big cult act now. That they're kind of like the Velvet Underground or something. Like, they didn't sell any records. They were not popular. They did like three albums that one didn't even get released. I mean, they had horrible distribution. They got radio play, but like, you couldn't find their record in most places. And they had this really kind of difficult, kind of sad run as a band, just a lot of failure. Until, fast forward like 10, 20 years later, when they developed kind of a following, with guys who would later go on to form bands like, REM and the Flaming Lips. So it's kind of one of those stories, like, where they finally get appreciated by people who are now rock stars, like, this band was an influence on us, and it's really, and the music is fantastic. I listen to like their first album, number one record, like, constantly.
That album's wicked good.
Oh yeah, you've heard it?
Yeah, it's
Yeah,
awesome.
like.
I have, yeah. It was one of those things that I kind of was introduced to in university, and I didn't realize there was a documentary about them, which instantly makes me want to see this because I do really like that album, but I don't know anything about them. So this is cool. It's very interesting to hear. I didn't realize that they were that underappreciated. So
Yeah, like you listen to their music and you're like, well, why didn't this hit? Because it's like, it's great pop music, and some of it's a little dark and a little like not as accessible, but it's all like fantastic music. And it just comes down to the fact that they just, you just couldn't find their record in a lot of stores. Like, that seems to be sort of the key issue. So it's just like kind of an interesting story of like missed opportunities and like sort of delayed recognition. And yeah, it's fantastic. And if you haven't heard their music before, even better. Like, see the documentary, and then you'll probably go out and buy the album, and all three of their albums, which you can get on iTunes, and you can get their first two albums in one release, for like $10. So it's just yeah, it's fantastic.
Cool.
So
No,
that's
that's
that.
a good one. That's that.
Well, that's my review.
That's that for that one. I was gonna say, Okay, well, I'm going to let you to do at least another big review of something that you've seen. So as a little segue, I'll throw in this is a Steven's monthly Bond update. Do like two for 2 minutes is that I'm deep into Roger Moore and don't really have much to say about The Spy Who Loved Me, but I just watched not too
Yeah,
long
that's
ago, but
great.
I'm very, very excited. Yeah, it was fun. It was I'm really digging Roger
Yeah.
Moore. I think that he already he's kind of feeling like he's just a better Bond than any. Well, I mean, George Lazenby will be my favorite Bond period, regardless. But he only did one film, so it's kind
Yeah.
of hard to gauge. But Roger Moore is way more impressive than Sean Connery by like a million, like million zillions. That's
And
it.
you
That's
can't say
my.
that
That's sort of
to
my.
you can't say that to a lot of people. You know, it's
Yeah, because there are people who are
there's that
purists. It's
Kirk
like it.
Picard, you know, divide in the Bond films with Connery and Moore, you know,
And well,
mainly.
I'm and so I mean I won't say much for Spy Love Me. It was fun. I enjoyed it, but I'm really, really, really excited about watching Moonraker next.
Moonraker, I have this set too, the big Blu-ray set of like all the movies. And you can get it now with Skyfall. Moonraker, I've never watched entirely.
Oh wow. So you should make it because I'm gonna be watching it this month.
Yeah,
So
I should watch
make a
that one
point of checking
too.
it
I
out.
mean, it's like probably the least loved of the Bond movies.
I know, but Bond goes to
Yeah,
space.
yeah.
I can't think of any movie where X goes to space in a franchise is a bad thing. There's things like Jason goes to space and Jason X. That was awesome. There's like Leprechaun goes to space. Brian Trenchard Smith's entry into the
Yep.
Leprechaun. Like that is good.
Everyone goes
So
to space
I it's mo
eventually.
it's called Moonraker, but in my mind I'm just excited because I get to watch James Bond goes to space. And I am fully aware that the space sequence is probably all about like 4 minutes of the movie, I have a sneaky
Probably.
suspicion. But
More
still
Raker
it's
than
gonna be
Moon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's Bond sort of, doing his yard work. But I don't know, that's what I thought of when you said that.
Lawn Raker.
But yeah, so look forward, ladies and gentlemen, to my review of James Bond in space
So wait a minute.
in future
Wait
podcasts.
a minute. Are you watching these all chronologically?
Yeah, I'm watching them
So you haven't
chronologically, and I have,
watched
remember, I haven't.
For Your Eyes Only yet?
No, because that's the one
Okay,
after
that you're gonna
Moonraker.
love that one. That one probably is the best. It could be the best Roger Moore one.
Oh, really?
In
Okay,
terms, I mean,
cool. Well, then
it's a
I'm.
little, I think at that when they did that one, they're like, okay, Moonraker was maybe a bit goofy, so we need
Okay.
to do a little bit more of a serious Bond.
Gotcha.
But don't get me
No,
wrong,
I
there's
mean.
goofiness to spare in For Your Eyes Only, but it's more of like a Pierce Brosnan Bond, but with Roger Moore.
Okay. All right,
So,
cool.
you know.
No, I mean, this is it. I'm doing them in order. And yeah, that's the one that follows Moonraker. So that'll be, I'm kind of curious. And I mean, I do expect Moonraker to be heavy on the cheese, but I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like,
No
it seems funny to
nutritional
say that because
value.
to be quite honest, all the movies are pretty heavy on the
Yeah,
cheese. I mean, the
more or less.
one-liners and the innuendo and whatnot, they're pretty. I mean, a lot that Spy Who Loved Me was over the top
Yeah.
ridiculous, but it was fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny how in a Bond film, these films have extraordinarily high body counts, like crazy. Like I know people talk about body counts in usually mostly in reference to like horror films and slashers, but Bond films are just it's amazing. Like the whole because I mean with Spy Who Loved Me they've got that whole that oil tanker that swallows submarines and there's this whole mutiny in one of those and it's just people are flying. Like the stunt work is fantastic. It's just it plays like a it's more like an Irwin Allen sort of disaster film than a Bond film, but I loved it. It was fun. But yeah, so anyways, it's more sort of my tease that Moonraker's up next, and I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, even the video game GoldenEye for like N64, I mean, all that game was you just going around killing people. That's
That's
all you
true.
do in that game is shoot people. That's
And it was
it.
awesome.
And maybe you gotta like defuse a bomb, but I mean,
Yeah.
essentially, you're just killing people.
Well, yeah, but that's because we all remember all we did was play the multiplayer, the four screen,
Yeah.
like the split screen multiplayer where we just had buddies over and you kill each other. There was, I think, some more Bondism sort of, I don't want to, you know, stealth kind of stuff in the single player game. But yeah, I mean, Bond, GoldenEye is finally remembered by myself as well. And I think in a lot of people as being, to be quite honest, until I started this set, GoldenEye was about the most extensive knowledge I had of Bond. Yeah. And that's why in the I think it was Odd Job. That was a couple films ago.
Right.
The only reason he was really recognizable to me is like, oh, you could play Odd Job in GoldenEye. He was the short guy. It was great to play multiplayer because people always missed you because you were smaller than some of the other characters. So, I mean, that was my identifier with that Bond character is going back to like the N64 game. Like, that's how little I know about the Bond films.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about the multiplayer, if you're playing with like two people, is essentially you're just playing hide and seek. It's just hide and seek, and if I find you, I'm going to shoot you in the head. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, the difference too between games like that then and now is you were sitting on the same couch, right? So you could see where if you were familiar with the map, you could tell where someone was hiding.
Yeah.
So you would just start heading toward. You would just have to look at their square, right? But nowadays, when you play online, you can't see the other person's screen, so you don't really know where they're hiding. Anyways, it's a lot of video game talk, but we could turn this into a video game podcast.
Oh, very easily.
Just let me know.
We kind of have in the past 20 minutes, but, you know, it's related to movies, so.
Yeah, well, exactly. Always. And, okay, so I'm throwing it to you. What do you got?
Well, I hesitate to call this a big release, considering that it bombed horribly over the weekend. But it is worth talking about is Spike Lee's remake of Old Boy.
Did you really expect it to be a huge mainstream hit, though? Or?
That's a good question. I mean, I guess there's a lot of reasons why it shouldn't have been. I mean, I think one of the reasons is that people love the original Old Boy, you know, myself included. And I think people were really offended that it was Americanized.
Right.
So they just stayed away from it. But to not even see it in the top 10, I mean, I don't always follow, like, you know, the weekend top 10, but I mean, it's interesting to kind of see something like that just not even show up. And I guess it just says a lot about the fact that people just resisted a remake. Or to people who didn't even know it was a remake, maybe it looked a little too bizarre.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so what's your take?
Well,
I'm dying to know.
I liked it. I think it's fine. But you know, it is a remake of a terrific, innovative, powerful movie. So it's obviously going to pale in comparison no matter what. So it's not great by any means, but I enjoyed it. I probably won't. I doubt I'll see it again. But I'll watch the original Old Boy again. You know what I mean?
Right.
So yeah, I mean, just one example is, you know, the opening shot of the original Old Boy is just, it just throws you right into the action where the main character is holding this guy by the tie off the tip of a roof or the edge of a tall building, and Spike Lee's version kind of starts a lot more conventionally with Josh Brolin playing the character this time going to work. So, you know, it just doesn't open with that. It doesn't open by grabbing you by the balls like the original did. Yeah. And so that's a really big, you know, weakness, a really big, you know, difference. But it does work. I mean, you know, it is well cast. You have Josh Brolin and Elizabeth Olsen, and the villain is played by how do you pronounce his name? Charlotte Copley?
I'm not even sure.
He was in District 9 and...
Oh, I know. I'm not sure of the pronunciation.
Yeah, there's so many actors nowadays, I can't pronounce their names. But anyway, he was in District 9 and he was the villain in Elysium, and he's the villain here. And he's really creepy in this, and it really effective. It kind of reminded me of like a really perverted, like Vincent Price. He's got kind of a Vincent Price, Peter Lorre thing going on with his performance that makes it kind of interesting. Because they could have just gotten, you know, typical American actor to play the role and it wouldn't have had as much, you know, flavor to it that he brings. So he's definitely one of the strong points. of the remake.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. So, I mean, I mildly recommending it for sure. But I mean, yeah. if you haven't seen the original.
How closely does it stick to, does it deviate at all? Like, I mean, I've seen the original a couple times. Does it move at all different in the third act, or is it pretty much, except for the change as far as the film opening, does it stick pretty close?
You know, to be honest, I've only seen the original Old Boy once a few years ago, so it wasn't really that fresh. Some really striking moments were, but as far as I know, I don't think it deviates on any fundamental level.
No. Okay. Have you seen the others in the Vengeance trilogy?
Yeah, I've seen, I think it was Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance.
Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, yeah.
Which I thought was kind of a difficult movie to really, I thought that movie was pretty tough. I mean, I admired a lot of it, but some of it would maybe turn me off a little bit.
Fair enough.
I haven't seen Lady Vengeance, but definitely I have that box set of the films on Blu-ray. So
you're not missing too much with Lady Vengeance. I am one of those weirdos who really love Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. Mm-hmm. I just love it. Mm-hmm. I prefer it even to Old Boy. I've never been one of those unabashed Old Boy lovers.
Right. Right.
As the entire world seems to be, but which makes me a little more intrigued by the remake, because I'm not so attached to the original that I think it's a travesty that they've remade it.
Okay, so maybe
I'm not in love
it.
With the casting necessarily, like with Josh Brolin, but I'm also not against it.
Mm-hmm.
I just that's why I'm curious, because I will totally watch this and I will see it. I don't know that I would necessarily take the trip to my local theater to see it, but to me it definitely screams Stephen will see it at some point. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, it's worth checking out. I mean,
it's been a decade, right? Or at least it might even be over a decade since Old Boy.
Oh, definitely.
Come out.
So, yeah, I mean, it has been a decade.
There's nothing wrong with the remake. I just it seems like this might be kind of interesting, but clearly, not a lot of people seem to think so.
Well, it made me think of the remake of Let the Right One In, which I love.
Right.
But the original.
But at least with that, it came out so close, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it was like Let the Right One In had barely, been out for what, like 2 years, even if it hadn't, maybe it hadn't even been 2 years, and already the remake had been. At least there's a little bit of breathing space with Old Boy. It's though I think it's been in production or pre-production or attempted production several times over the last decade. But yeah, that remake for Let the Right One In it was Let Me In, I think they renamed it. Is that one's really useless. But
I like
it's just the same movie. Yeah, but it's just the same movie. Without subtitles.
Yeah, you're probably right.
It was like, you know what? It's a very well-made film, and I think it's a case for, if you saw the remake first, you'd prefer it to the other just because it's the one you saw first. Like, it's strong enough on its own merits. I just think as a remake, it didn't really try to do anything different with the original material.
Which is what you have to do, really. I mean, case in point, the remake of Psycho. Now that's useless.
Yeah,
it's fascinating, but pointless.
It is fascinating because Van Sant was specifically trying to do a shot-by-shot remake.
Yeah.
So, I mean, why? I'm not quite sure. But I think it's kind of cool that he did it with a Hitchcock film, though, being as Hitchcock remade his own films. So,
you
definitely know that Hitchcock wouldn't have been adverse to people, attacking his films, but you just have to wonder about that one, because it seemed more like, hey, I've got a budget and there's a studio is going to let me make a film, and I thought I always thought it'd be kind of cool to remake a film shot by shot. Let's do Psycho. Like, it seemed more that kind of case, but I don't know. Plus Vince Vaughn didn't really do it for me.
No, that was a really odd casting.
Yeah, really,
really odd. Interesting, but odd.
Yeah, like I feel like that movie should have been awesome. It could have potentially been awesome, but I think some of the casting was a bit weird. I really liked what's his name, William H. Macy, as the detective. Was really cool in that film. But
yeah, the Martin Balsam role.
Yeah, exactly. But Old Boy, eh?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I guess it this doesn't bode well for them remaking any of the other trilogy.
Oh, doubtful. Doubtful.
Easy.
But on that note, I think we're done for another episode.
Yeah, that's crazy. Man, it clips by fast.
Yeah.
That is just insane. I cannot believe that is another month down, mm-hmm. and another handful of interesting films, and some homework for Andrew to go watch some Deal of the Century.
I'm excited. This is definitely, you know.
Don't be too excited now. Just saying.
Well, my expectations are low, but I'm looking forward to it.
Good. Cool. Well, thanks, and hopefully everyone had fun listening.
Yeah.
And, I'll let you outro us out.
Of course, we'll do. You can find us online at letterboxpod.blogspot.ca, and you can find us on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smartphone podcast app, and please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review the show. That's pretty much all you need to know.
That is, and that I finally have partaken in the Stitcher app, and it's awesome.
Oh, good.
So if anyone's wondering, it's really cool. I actually listened to our last episode. I don't usually listen to our episodes in their entirety,
mm-hmm.
but I listened to the last one using the app and a bunch of my other podcasts. And
you get them
really
all
cool.
in one there. So definitely.
Yeah, I really, really like that. So I recommend people using that for sure.
All right. Well, until then, Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yes.
Because
indeed.
We probably won't be talking again until the new year or close to the new year anyway.
Yeah, exactly. 2014. Here we come.
Yeah, another year done. And still a lot more movies to see. So until then, thank you for listening.
Have fun.